This storm has caused confusion and delay.
You have caused
confusion and delay.
I think you are facing prejudice.
Daisy is just the ultimate thought. Daisy is just the ultimate thought.
Your impatience has caused confusion and delay. This storm has caused confusion and delay. You are causing confusion and delay. You cause confusion and delay.
26 years old and you can't even drive? I can. Are you stupid, eh? Are you a stupid fool? Well, why can't you drive then? You can't even drive. Bit grey today.
Not sure about that new intro. It's too jolly. It's too much like mirth and laughter in it. Do you think?
What's the quote from me in there? I can't really hear it. Does anyone know?
No. To me, it suggests the Deepest Lore is a show about banter, which is not quite accurate.
I like it. I don't know if I scolded God and I said to take my voice out of it. I can't bear hearing it. But he asked me for like spicy clips of Pharaoh. But I forgot, so I don't know what's in there.
Well, anyway, sorry, we're a little bit late. I was dicking around.
Confusion and delay is what it was.
So that's what we were doing. I was downloading pictures of books. Anyway, before we get started, do buy my courses, ladies and gentlemen, especially the Trivium and Foundations of Writing. I'm doing a big push on that. Although, of course, I am here with the author of Foundations of Entrepreneurship, which is a great course. It's a banger course.
Exactly. You know, now's the perfect time to learn more about starting a business and to get selling. It's a perfect gift. You know, buy it for a friend or for a loved one. Buy it for grandma.
I've seen if I've got the advert here. Oh, here we are. Look. All right, so this says Foundations of Entrepreneurship. Anything else you'd like to plug, Pharaoh, this week?
Nope, nothing yet.
D, anything you'd like to plug, sir?
I may do another Twitter space. I'm sort of laying off of them until they fix that error because most of my friends can't join, but may do one tonight, you know. Unfortunately, if I do one whilst Spaces is still broken, I'm left with Kaz and Oliver. So,
oof.
Oh, we love them.
I mean, so. I discovered today that the use of shampoo apparently is too much for my caveman followers. He's like, what you gay? You use shampoo? I use the dirty stream water of a waterfall.
I use the blood of mine enemies. Yeah, I mean, it's Twitter, you know, you can't post anything without people bitching at you. So I use olive oil soap in my hair. I mean, I've just always done that, so.
But you don't use egg whites and mustard, D, to wash your hair?
I know, it's shameful. I used to use shampoo, if I have it. There's some, like, rose scent. I went to a hairdresser. Imagine that.
You need to bring up the shampoo that you were tweeting out, D, because it was shame. That was shameful. Some kind of, like, it was like a 1970s...
Oh, I love that. It was amazing.
Wasn't it Vosine?
No, it was Clairol Herbal...
Essences.
Oh, yeah. And Pharaoh, I half of the reason that I selected that is because I remember it was like 1995. I was just so amazed that they hadn't changed this bottle in like, you know, then at least 20 years, which has made me buy it. I love
it
when there's
the
70s, like,
yeah, it's great.
Yeah, I love when there's products that just stick obstinately with one design and they never change it, but they've changed it now, so I don't use them anymore. It smells good too. It smells quite good.
There's something about that where many brands refuse to change like logos or looks for a long period of time. But I would say that there is this big trend of modernifying everything, you know, for the classic flattening and simplifying logos, etc.
It's
like all of the character of these brands just destroyed and turned into, you know, these whatever, so art cal, whatever they call it. You know,
I have no idea, by the way, I tweeted out what shampoo I've got because I just go to Sainsbury's and they'll have a sale, like half price sale. Buy Phil Smith, Be Gorgeous, and Aussie Meg. I was like, okay, they're the ones on offer, so I'll buy them. But I was getting stick because apparently this is gay shampoo. So
I mean, it's called Cocolicious. So
I kind of like it.
Phil Smith, Be Gorgeous. Did he not?
Oh my god, it is called that. Oh my god,
I'm worth it though.
What's the bottle? What's the bottle behind the two? What is that?
Oh, that is AAA's body wash or whatever it is. Okay. She's got like she's got travel stuff for if she comes to the lodge. That's basically
My dog has a whole my dog has a whole panoply of products more than I.
AAA hate showers, by the way. I don't know if you ever tried to give a shower to a 3-year-old. Absolutely despises it.
Does she like a bath?
Oh, of course, yeah. I mean, 9 times out of 10, she'll have a bath with bubbles in it and so on.
Yeah, that's the aristocrat's choice.
But I need it for reasons. On the weekend, I needed to give her a shower. And talk about going ballistic.
Oh,
I went absolutely crazy. So, anyway.
She's right.
Let us talk about books. Pharaoh, last week we looked at the covers of books. This week we're going to go between the sheets, as it were, between the covers.
Yeah, so this is kind of like a potted history of illustration and maybe touching a little bit on design as well. So again, this is relatively broad. Just a couple of caveats before we start. I've only focused on the Western canon, and I think there are a number of international books that are worthy to be covered, such as the Persians, you know, some excellent beautiful illustrations and manuscripts, but for the sake of brevity, it's just going to be Western pieces.
How can you leave the Persians out? I'm only joking.
Yeah, because the thing is, then I'd have to include the Japanese and the Chinese, because I mean the Japanese is hugely influential from a design perspective on the Western canon, hugely.
Okay, so, fair enough.
And they like kind of help invent the technology. So,
what, paper?
Well, no, printing.
All right, okay.
Well, paper as well. I hate to say.
I thought paper was Chinese, famously, right?
It depends on what type of paper. It's never so simple.
Okay.
So yeah, it's we're looking on the outside, now we're looking on the inside. So please bear with us, and I know that we've got some special images from Mr. D as we go through everything. Doesn't look like it's downloaded. Can we go back to the beginning? Sorry, I think this is not the first image.
Oh,
okay, it's done the sorted by.
Oh, all right, hold on a minute. It's done it by date again. Hold on. Okay, now I've got it.
Yeah, so if you remember last time, we sort of began this kind of manuscript journey at the beginning of the late Roman Empire. And one of the earliest examples of an illustration that still lives with us is in what is known as the Cotton Genesis book, which is you can see it's a late Roman Greek book. It's made on cotton paper. Unfortunately, it got it's in the British Library, but it got set on fire in the 18th century, and this is all that remains of it.
I was just going to say that was famous and terrible fire. The book belonged to oh dear, I can't remember. His name was Cotton. It was the Cotton, Sir Robert Cotton. And it was the Cotton Library, and it, yes, famously burnt, and many, many just completely priceless manuscripts were destroyed. So, yeah.
But just a couple of things that's interesting. So obviously, maybe this isn't Vellum then. Maybe I've misremembered, and Cotton's the name of the guy instead. But just in terms of you know, writing, these would obviously all be handwritten and then hand painted by illustrators. Now, I'm actually not. I don't think there's much information about those kind of early or the late Roman period illustrators, but I imagine it's going to be monks and like monastery staff. But the Byzantines didn't have the same kind of monastery network as the West did at this time. But I mean, just in terms of a piece of work here, I mean, if you can have. You can see the kind of mountain in the background. You've got, you know, these could be two saints on the left hand side, but you know, it's a very well rendered piece of work, I think, for the time, and it's kind of reminiscent a little bit of some Byzantine or like late Roman mosaic works, if that makes sense. So, you know, good quality illustration begins very early on in about 440.
I would like to voice scepticism that the guy who owned this was called Cotton in 440.
No. He owned it in the 17th century in England.
Oh, right. Okay. Sorry. Right.
He bought it, and Cotton's heir gifted it to the British nation.
That makes more sense. I can believe that guy in the 1700s was called Cotton, but not in 440.
No.
So. In terms of the types of books that we talked about last time, it was, you know, certainly during this like late Roman and then medieval period, it's Bibles, it's liturgical documents, but also I mentioned around a number of books for like health and healing, with, you know, Galen being very popular. But if you go to the next image, this is it's another late Roman Byzantine book. And it's called the Naples Dioscurates. It's again those horrible Greek names, but it's effectively a like a healer's book of herbs with illustrations in it at the same time. So underneath you've got kind of you've got the names of the different like herbs and spices on the top there, and this is obviously in the O section here. I'll see if I can. That's like Origanisostis is the middle one, for example. And then there's kind of descriptions of how it's used to kind of heal and help people. So this is kind of like the NHS of the day. You know, it's a very you know, rare book, because there's not many of these kind of healers books out there. But I think it's very beautiful. But again, kind of, we often think about this kind of period as being just wall-to-wall illustrated Bibles, etc. But actually there were a wider range of books than you might think. But
and those illustrations are surprisingly, you know, sort of life. I mean, you could certainly identify the plants from those illustrations. They're amazing botanical illustrations at the time.
If you show those to me, I'd have thought they were from much later, like,
yeah,
probably like 17th century or something like that. If I had to guess, just looking at them, but
yeah, it looks quite modern. It looks like quite modern.
Yeah, I mean, just a note on the kind of the style and the artistry itself. I believe that these are all egg based paints. So again, you'd have. Like a pigment which is then tempered by an egg yolk, which then kind of like when you paint it on it, it sets. Now the upshot of that is that it gives a very kind of graphic and very colourful view, but it also it restricts you on the amount of pigments. So again, we're very spoiled today where you can go to a CasArt or whatever and pick up tens of thousands of different pigments and types of paints, but you would literally have there was a much smaller range available to you, and an illustrator would have to hand grind and hand mix their own paints. I'm sure Dee, you've gone through the process.
Oh, I do it all the time, and I've done a body of work using these techniques. I would amend that and say that these were probably not egg yolk; they were probably egg white, which is called, in this connotation, is called glaire. And so, what the painter would do was grind the pigment. So, in other words, they would take this usually powdered pigment, and they would put it on a stone, and then they would use another stone like a pestle. And they would add water to it and grind it. And what that would do, it would separate out all the particles. It would get all the clumping away, and it would wet each particle uniformly. And so they would make a water paste, and then they would scrape it up, often put it in either a bladder or in a shell, like an empty clamshell or oyster shell. And then when they would paint, they would take a bit of this paste, and they would mix it with either glaire, which is water and egg white, whipped together, or something called hydromel, which was honey and water. And what and later on, and in some circumstances, they will also use vegetable gum, something like modern gum arabic. And you would sort of do this as you painted. It was a very painstaking process. I mean, the reason that egg yolk wasn't often used on flexible media is because it becomes brittle and cracks, usually is done on hardboard, but it's possible. This would now be called, like, the closest approximation to this paint you could buy now is called gouache or body color, which is,
I mean, forgive me for interrupting, but 1500 year egg white, I mean, doesn't it go off?
Because it's dried.
It just stays indefinitely, like, for the end of time.
It's the proteins in
it's
the
egg. Protein. Yeah,
yeah, sort of like bind it in place, basically. That's
what, forever. This will never fade.
Well, the pigments do fade. It depends on the pigment. In fact, I should let Dee speak because you're much,
Well, you're absolutely you know this as well as I. But yes, some pigments are what we call quite fugitive. But the advantage of books and manuscripts is that they're usually closed. They're kept closed almost all the time, and they're opened only briefly, and they're exposed. And certainly in this period, they wouldn't have been exposed to much natural light. So generally, paintings in books, manuscript illuminations and illustrations hold up very well. They look almost as if they're new because they've been kept in the dark for, all of their history. But yeah, certain pigments are very fugitive. So indigo pigments, madder pigments, they would use something, there's several different greens. This sort of plant looking, this kind of yellowish green is often from buckthorn berries. It's called sap green in a modern context. But yeah, I mean, you can't use these pigments very well on paintings that are exposed to light, but they're perfect books,
Yeah, just a couple of things, just in terms of like the stability. It's basically light, water, I guess kind of physical elements, and protesters are the four biggest ways of damaging artworks. But and again, you've got to choose your medium and your pigments for the context. So for example, again, something like a fresco, which is designed to be exposed to the elements, because it's literally sort of attached to like render itself, it has that, it retains some of the hardness of the kind of concrete, at the expense of you're having to paint on fresco. It's literally drying as you paint, so it's super unforgiving. Yeah. And you can't get the kind of, like, I guess, color brightness in some kind of ways. So
yeah, and unless you're a master, I mean, you have to basically you lay the plaster down, and you can only paint as much on plaster that's laid the same day. And if you make a mistake, you have to wait until it dries, and then you have to chip it off and start again. And also, fresco is extraordinarily chemically harsh because, of course, you're laying the pigments are getting laid into a crystal matrix that forms, you know, literally when you do it. And if you ever set concrete or plaster, you'll know that it's exothermic; it heats up as it cures. And so there are many pigments you can't use in fresco. You're quite limited. With these manuscript illustrations, you have much more freedom because you can use almost anything, almost any pigment on them. So it's strangely enough, I mean, even though it's of course quite delicate, but it's also tends to be one of the most durable because of its circumstances. Yeah.
Just going back to the kind of style of the painting, because of the medium you're working in, it tends to be very vivid in color. It's hard to blend paints together. So if you think about oil painting, someone like Sargent, for example, you know, he is doing a lot of blending. He's having these very loose brush strokes in his work. This is the opposite to that. You're everything's super precise, super definite, high value, and that gives you a certain kind of effect, right? But I really like the plants on the left-hand side, and just note how it's a combination of there is elements of naturalism here. So again, you've got the kind of roots coming out, but the illustrator here has, I guess, kind of if you see the leaves, I've been regulated, and they've all kind of been they've done a certain spacing to give it that kind of artistic effect at the same time. So that there's an interesting mix of both trying to kind of show the plant properly, but also having a bit of artistic flair with the work. We've got two other pages. I really like the next one because it looks like a little man root. There we go.
it's like that thing that comes alive in Pan's Labyrinth.
It is mandrake. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. So, and I think there's one more picture as well. But you get the idea. But I really quite
dill,
like to...
beside the mandrake. Well, quite like dill.
Oh. Yeah, it could be. It should be. That's like beside the mandrake. If you go back a second.
Hold on. This one on the left.
Yeah. Militophia.
Yeah. Yeah. I do like the mandrake.
Yeah.
I can't. I'm very bad at my Greek is very bad, so I
yeah.
I'm not able to tell.
Yeah. Okay. So let's go on to the next. So obviously by this point again, this is 500. You've got the kind of east and west fully split, and you've got the rise of the Germanic kingdoms in the north. And if we go to the next image. We've got an interesting oddity here. This is the Codex Argentus. Now, with the rise of the Germanic tribes, they had a dual need. Firstly, spreading their Arianism. So again, if you remember that most of those kind of Gothic tribes or Germanic tribes were not Orthodox, but followed the kind of teachings of it of Arius, is it? Oh, Arian, it should be, yes. Doctrinally, so they had like different theological views, and because of that, they had the need of different theological documents. And this is a very beautiful piece of work. Now, the first thing you'll notice is that the vellum itself is purple in color, and the I think this was created for one of those Gothic emperors. I can't remember who. Each piece of the vellum was dipped in dye to create this kind of dark purple effect, and then a silver-like pen was used over the top. And it's a very eye-catching. It sort of reminds me. I always think of Lord of the Rings or Tolkien. with some of his elvish scripts and stuff like that that he has, just in terms of kind of like the kind of likeness. But I thought it's a very interesting and quite novel piece. So again, it's not just about the words, but also, you know, you can change the pages themselves.
Yeah, and people should be aware that the purple used to dye this parchment was most probably murex, what was called imperial purple or Tyrian purple, which was the purple of the ancient time, literally the Roman emperor's robe, and used into Byzantine times as well. And then this was the most expensive dye available, because it took, I mean, you literally had to kill 10,000 of these sea snails to get a very small amount of this dye. So it was only used for very auspicious purposes, and it was the only purple, you know, what the ancients called purple dye available until the 19th century, really. There was no other color, there was no other way to make purple. You will never see purple in paintings before the 19th century either. You couldn't do it. There was no pigment that produced that color.
I would say that there were a number of false purples, as they were called, where people would mix something like indigo and madder to create a purple-like color, but they were actually illegal in the Eastern Roman Empire, and people would get heavily fined for them, you know, because it's a very powerful color, and it's kind of like it's a way of sorting hierarchy, if that makes sense. Think of some of the laws around clothing in the medieval period, where certain people could only wear certain types of clothes, or like things like cloth of gold, for example. It's the same thing with dyes and colors. It's an instant signifier of your status in society. And these Germanic tribes, who we often think as, you know, roving barbarians at this time, you know, were obviously making a big effort to seem like they were cultured civilizational forces at the time. So, you know, I think it's a really lovely work. There's actually quite a few of these dyed books I found, you know, like four or five different codexes, but it seems to have gone out of fashion pretty quickly, possibly because of the sheer number of sea slugs required to kill.
Well, there's still piles of the shells of these in certain places that are there from ancient times, you know. So it gives an idea of how many of these were used. You can still get, I have a very, very small sample of it, but it's almost impossible to get. I know of one concern that makes it, but it's very, very dear. It's the most expensive pigment that I have in my collection. So.
I like the idea of the APL, the Anti-Purple League, you know, shutting down. I just have one small question, which is that in that third arch there on the, you know, the third one from the left, is that the number 7? That looks like, that kind of looks like algebraic numbers. What is that?
Is that not the...
Looks like the number 7 to me. I'm just wondering, kind of sticks out. So it looks unusual.
I can't see it on my screen. I don't know if there are my.
No, I'm not sure. I can't even remember what script this is written in. I imagine it's some kind of Latinized Germanic, but it's not Greek. I'll tell you that. So
it looks very much like the way the number 7 in Farsi is written.
Okay,
that's why that's why I'm wondering, because it's the shape of it and everything.
I mean, the Goths are Aryan, so maybe that's where they got it from.
Okay, let's carry on.
And those arches do look very much like the engraving at the door of what's the mine, Moria.
Yeah, speak friends and enter. Yes, yeah. Okay. We've got another manual, and obviously, as kind of related to, because again, I wanted to kind of show that people say, oh, my dark ages, you know, science and learning isn't happening, and again, this just not true. This again, this book, the Vienna Discordes, made in 512, again has a number of beautiful illustrations of plants and I guess kind of natural philosophy, as we'd say. But I quite like this quite charming selection of birds, and there's an entire book of birds identifying them, talking through different symbolic meanings, etc. And I do wonder whether some of our kind of medieval bestiaries, which kind of list out all of the kind of mythological creatures, begin with some of these late Roman, early Byzantine scientific documents, basically, where again this is about trying to kind of pass on learning and understanding to each other. But again, these illustrations are very fine and as good as some of the best mosaics of this time. So you know, it's a very good quality art. If you look at, there's an emu on the top left, for example. And again, is that like a goose-like bird? There's shading on there. There's, you know, attempts to kind of you know, bring a wide variety of colours as best they can with the pigments. So I think a really charming, beautiful book.
I don't like the way the emu has got free of his boundaries. Get back to your tenements, emu. Back to your tenements. Anyway,
back in the box.
It's quite good. It's quite good to go. Cause again, looking at that, you'd think, you know, if you just to show me that, I'd never guess it was from this period. You just don't think of stuff like this being made, you know, right in the kind of, this is not even the Middle Ages. It's like medieval era, really early medieval era, or even exactly, like late, very, very late antiquity. Yeah. You could say. This is like meant to be the no man's time. No man's land of civilization.
Well, this is it. Often this kind of like early Dark Age period is like barbarian tribes tearing down civilization. But I think it is a more complicated thing to that. And I think the barbarians were more civilized than we think. And also there was still a lot of learning going on. I think actually it's the Islamic conquests had a bigger effect on the world from a learning perspective, and that marks a serious downturn in these kind of documents. So you know, bearing in mind that the whole of North Africa was a vitally important for Rome, but also for the Eastern Romans, but also for the Germanic tribes, you know, the Vandals were there, for example. Augustine comes from modern day Algeria, etc. All of that lost. And you know, the breadbasket of Egypt, the Levant, very, very wealthy, important trade routes at the same time. So I personally feel like the true Dark Age begins with the Muslim invasions, because just from a financial perspective, it you know, all of the kind of money from trade, etc., is gone overnight, basically.
And of course, famously, the pump stopped working, didn't they? Because the Vandals took the handles. Carry on, Pharaoh. Never mind.
Terrible.
So
now we're going to move on a little bit. And when we're talking about kind of illustration and manuscripts, Britain actually has a long and wonderful legacy, specifically the so-called Celtic Church, where basically the Celtic... Celtic Christianity had been well established for a long period of time, but also a number of like proper monasteries in places like Iona, for example, were created and thriving, and had a lot of support and a lot of people there as well, and became, you know, areas of power. And I think this is around about 700 AD now. This marks the move away from those kind of really like late Roman works into your proper medieval manuscripts, again with a focus on monastic life and monastic creation. But stylistically, it's still very eclectic. There isn't that kind of homogenic power from Rome. And obviously, the Celtic Christians, they're living on, you know, the very edge of society and civilization itself, often would take these interesting forms. We saw this on some of the covers, I don't know if you remember last time, but the Book of Durrow is the first example of a real masterwork, which has these combination of Christian and Celtic and really Germanic symbology at the same time. So again, you know, this could be taken from one of those Norwegian Viking churches, for example. At the same time, there's also some really lovely, if very simple, illustrations in here as well. If you go to the next slide, we mentioned last time about the four symbolic gospel writers, and they kept coming up on the face over and over again. This is the man or the angel. And the Book of Durrow has one of each of those, but I just like this illustration as a lovely piece of art. In terms of realism and pose and that kind of those classical features, all of that's been lost and subsumed to this totally flat graphic man. Look at his feet; they're put side on.
It looks like he's from Mr. Ben or something like that.
it does look like a 70s cartoon or something like that, but it has this very kind of bold graphic quality at the same time that I really appreciate. And I just love his face, that kind of, you know, these guys just gave him this horrible like scowl and waterfall hair coming down from the back, you know. But I think this does show that a lot of those traditions were certainly not passed on. And again, go back to that Cotton Genesis, you know, the illustrations in there are very good quality in terms of the rendering of the human accurately. You know, this is,
I'm wondering what these creatures are here. Are they meant to be snakes or I'm only mentioning that because I've just recorded the myths and legends for this week. And it's about this massive worm creature called the Stor Worm. I believe it's Norse in origin. So I'm wondering if this is some like sort of mythical beast or if it's meant to be snakes, or do you have any idea what they're meant to be?
Yes, some of them are just like lions. So can you see in the middle on the left hand side? I think those are meant to be lions, but I think there are, I think the rest are worms. And again, you know, whatever the things like the world tree and, the kind of the snake which wraps itself around there, that all passes through to these kind of Celtic traditions as well, but they just kind of Christianify it.
Why were they obsessed with giant worms? They come up a lot in these tales. I'm just wondering, like, what the deal? I mean, this Stor Worm that it's big enough to wrap itself around the entire world. That's how big it is, you know. So I'm just wondering, like, what the deal is. Why do these giant creatures crop up
symbolic of the lower nature of the world, I suppose. I don't know.
Interesting.
Or whether just gigantic dinosaur like snakes knocking.
Yeah,
like that. What's that one in Star
Wars? Monster.
What's that one you glimpse in Star? Is it in Star Wars? You glimpse it briefly, where they, there's that giant worm that kind of
the space worm thing
lives
yeah.
on a moon or whatever.
Yeah.
And anyway. This is all the sandworms from June.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Let's carry on.
So moving away, so there's basically that Durrow book is the kind of beginning of kind of Celtic traditions, but some of those Roman traditions are still kept. Now, note, this is actually a Syriac work. So think of modern day Syria today, and obviously Syria is hugely important in the kind of Christian world because of Antioch and the kind of religious significance of that. Think of Paul of Tarsus, you know, on his way to Antioch, etc. but they also had a significant Christian population even after the Islamic invasions. Now, this was written, this was made in around about 750, 100 years after the Islamic invasions. And there are still reminiscences of the old Roman works. If you think, I don't know if you can remember back to that Cotton Genesis illustration, the Roman style is to basically, it's very contained in a square, basically. It's a single scene or image contained in a square. But it's just obviously a much worse version of those late Roman versions that we saw earlier. So I think again, this idea that during the Dark Age everything was lost just is not true. Traditions were still there, and they were still passed down, and these books still did exist.
I mean, isn't it more that they say that the center of gravity shifted from the West to the Middle East and the Near East? I guess that's what they usually say. In there, it's not like nothing was happening in the world. It's just the center of gravity wasn't Europe for that period.
Yeah,
that's what they claim. You know,
I think there's definitely an element to that. But I've definitely heard things where basically it's kind of like it's a totally dead age of culture, and you know, some people are extreme enough to say, oh, and it doesn't come back till the Renaissance or whatever. But these Roman traditions were carried on in specific areas, basically, I wanted to kind of point out. I also really like the Syriac script, which sadly is lost now. I think they just use an Arabic script. But if you look below, it kind of looks a little bit like Arabic or Ethiopian.
Yeah, I'm wondering if they go left to right or right to left.
I'm not sure.
That'd be interesting to know if it was a right-to-left language or... okay.
Now this is, again, a bit of a curiosity, because ultimately, you're dealing with traditions and different monasteries like working in a certain way and then passing down that knowledge generationally. And that means you basically get similar types of works or similar ways of rendering. But because an illustration is effectively, you know, someone drawing something, there is always a fringe of eclecticism and unique designs. And this is from the Ebo Bibles, the Ebo Gospels. And it has a very frantic, sketch-like quality to it at the same time. It kind of reminds me a little bit of almost like a proto Blake in some ways. I don't know, D, if you've got any thoughts on the kind of artistic nature of this.
Yeah, I mean, certainly the way the lines in the drapery and the lines in the landscape, you know, that there's a lot of movement there that you don't tend to see on works of this period. So he's quite curious.
He reminds me of the Yes Dear Wojak, you know. No, he does though. He's got an element of like, if only you knew how bad things
were. Well, he probably did. And that's exactly what he was thinking.
Yeah. He's literally just got like his I thought there was a horn of wine, but maybe it's a horn of ink in his left hand there. Maybe he's just like sipping some wine while, you know, society's burning behind him. I mean, it wasn't...
I like that. You wouldn't want to put ink in a horn because, unless you had something that, like a stand for it, because it would be... You know, how nerve-wracking
go everywhere.
A horn full of ink, yeah, they go everywhere, yeah. all over your script you're writing. So.
Is there smoke coming out of it? I'm just what's that there?
I think that is like a muse or the Holy Spirit inspiring our gospel writer here, and it's worth taking a look through. One thing I would say is that I've just taken like one or two images from each of these books, so, and often they're online if you go to the library where these are stored, so you can look through all the different illustrations inside them, and it's quite entertaining. But
some wag should remake the Yes Dear meme with him inserted instead. Anyway, carry on.
Okay, we're going to head back to Celtic Christianity, and we're now at 850. So 100 years of Celtic tradition culminates in my book of Kells, possibly Ireland's finest achievement ever.
Apart from the works of Keith Woods, of course.
Bold statement.
Carry on.
And again, it's another illustrated gospel like before, but it is obviously a refinement of ability and style and design to create something like totally unlike anything else on the planet. So again, you can see things like, oh, look, there's a person at the top there, and again, he's rendered very, very plainly. But look at all of these kind of intricate graphical elements that have been built up. You've got things like the Celtic knot, which is has been kind of fully kind of codified and evolved, which obviously comes out of those earlier traditions, but has been kind of refined and adapted. You know, this is a masterwork of design, because even though you've got all of that kind of complexity and depth, there's something still harmonious about it. It still pulls mm-hmm. together. And again, the Book of Kells is something you can just spend hours looking through different illustrations. I've just got a couple of other, some of my other favorite pieces from here.
It is lovely, this piece.
Yeah, I would also say that there's something almost mandala-like about many of the sort of designs. I mean, you know, you almost get these kind of stylized fractals and such. Mm. Amazing work.
Is this figure here playing the harp? What's happening there? What's going on?
Well,
there?
I think it's meant to be a letter, but then again, yeah, like they're kind of adapting it so it's because that's tied into again. Sorry, Semigog knows way more about this than I do, but often with things like alphabets, they would use like letters plus images to help with memory and to kind of conjure up a specific remembrance. Because again, because of the lack of books, people would use these as remembrance tools so that they could go out to their local village and, you know, preach from the Gospels by heart or whatever.
I feel like this has influenced so many like RPG video games and so on that I'm just thinking, like, how can I unlock this door? You know, because those circles would light up and it would it's obviously like a secret door in like a video game made in 2003 or something, you know. I mean, people are saying it looks like a dungeon in Skyrim or something, but I mean, they have inspired a lot of like this look.
Yeah,
something that is right. deep yeah, in yeah. the culture, isn't it? You know, so
yeah.
We've
got two other little bits from Kells. Again, this is the I think it's meant to be like an interpretation of the Cairo. So
yeah.
The Cairo is the first two letters of Christ's name in Greek. Chi as in C, and then Rho as in. No, it's the Chi as in it's CH, isn't it? Is the sound, and then Rho is the R.
Yeah.
And the Chi isn't looks like an X to us, and then the Rho looks a bit like an R, and so you've got this super stylized, amazing X, which sort of curves up. It's sort of much longer on the left side than the right, giving those. Feelings of the row at the same time, and this is one of my favorite Kairos that's ever been created. Again, it's almost got like a psychedelic quality as well, I think, where, you know, with all those, you know, fractals and the
wheels,
three
wheels, yeah.
Yes, yeah,
the man on the end of this figure here,
yeah, and all yeah, so that's a very important point, is that these are the groups of three, as Ferris says, but the Trinity.
Yeah, I didn't even notice that. Like, yeah, man's head on a. Yeah.
I mean, if I was facing this, that would be the first thing I'd be trying to like use head to see if I can open the door. but yes, yeah, very good, very interesting actually. You could imagine this on the front of many a 1968 lost psychedelic album. Lots of them kind of looked had these kind of swirls and so on. Kind of mesmerizing. It's quite amazing, this. When was this from, Pharaoh, again? This particular...
800. Oh, no, 850. So this is, like, the height of Celtic Christianity. I got to say that by this time, like, Celtic Christianity had already been heavily aligned to Catholics. So if you think of Bede yeah. talks about how he basically, like, frog-marched all of the Celtic bishops to Rome to agree to the same calendar and stuff like that. So if you read between the lines, the Catholicization of the Celtic Church had already begun, but they still retained a very definite cultural identity until about 900 AD, I would say. This is kind of like, this is the end for Celtic culture. Although, interestingly, there have been a number of revival movements. I think if it's in the High Victorian period with like Archibald Knox or G.F. Watts's wife, for example.
You know what I can't stop thinking of looking at this, and I'm wondering if it's related in some way, is the design on the standard pack of playing cards. There seems to be a lot of like just the basic patterns, and maybe it's the fact it's the heart, like the shape of the hearts and the spades and so on. I'm wondering if whoever designed those playing cards ever had something like this in mind, because it's kind of,
Interesting on the playing cards. I do know that, you know, there's different playing cards depending on which European country. So, for example, the Germans use like bells and acorns. Do you know about this?
Yeah.
So they every European country has its own playing card traditions, basically, in different symbols.
I thought the one that we use, I thought was adapted from a French set. I did an econ shorts on it once because it was an example of. I seem to recall it. You had to have a special license from the king to sell playing cards. So there was like a kind of underground black market for like
They were sold with a stamp, and in fact, that tradition remains. You know, many packs of cards, you will see the sort of vestige of that with literally a sort of seal closing the pack.
Can you see what I mean, though? In the general, like, there's something of the playing card in this. I'm wondering if it borrowed from it in some way, you know. Anyway, let's carry on. I have an inkling that
there's a famous American manufacturer of cards called Bicycle, which uses the kind of wheel of an old penny farthing bicycle as a kind of motif, as an engraved motif, and it does look a lot like those wheels.
And this is again one of those kind of gospel writers, similar to who we saw in Darrow. But again, what blows my mind is that you have all of that design ability and detailed ornamentation, and yet, you know, they're rendering their humans very simply here. I mean, look at the face. This is, you know, super stripped back. You know, it's even, I would say, simpler than like Byzantine iconography, even, you know, it's super graphic. Whether that's a decision or an ability thing, I just feel like they're just not bothered about the human form whatsoever. There's just total emphasis on form itself and shape, and maybe emeralds.
It's so schematic looking. I mean, I would guarantee that that's a different hand from the person who was doing the abstract flourishes. You know?
Yeah, you'd have a team of, you know, a team of monks working on them at different levels, and they'd all been given different pieces, and they'd all be trained in different ways. I mean, that must have taken like at least a year, that previous work. So,
I mean, is it just me, or are these getting like increasingly trippy as far as we're going?
Yeah, I mean, yeah.
This is pretty trippy, isn't it?
That's pretty far out, yeah.
I'll avoid my rant about that. We'll talk about Boomer Truth, but this idea that we cannot escape ever looking at anything like this now without thinking of drugs.
Yeah, I mean, my mind's going, what's that movie from the 70s, like The Holy Mountain or something?
Jodorowsky. Yeah.
You know what I mean, though, right? That connection is so vivid for me. I'm actually wondering how much like Celtic revivalism was in the kind of 60s and the hippies and so on. Like,
well, a lot of that came out of the 60s and 70s, certainly. And you can find lots of, you know, pop culture examples of that where it's, you know, they start writing into the music. The British kind of folk scene, electro folk scene later on was, you know, hugely into that. So.
Are these peacocks appear in the top left?
Yeah, that's right. Peacocks is the symbol of life, and also the pomegranate, because if it's left to ripen on the tree, it bursts open with its fruit. There isn't one on there, but they're often twinned with
the irresistible pomegranate. Indestructible? What was it? Incorruptible.
The incorruptible pomegranate that came from one of my spaces where Semigog and I had a whole thing going into pomegranates. I told the tale. I'll be very brief. I told the tale that years ago I keep a big bowl of fruit in the kitchen or dining room because I'm a fruit enjoyer, and I had a pomegranate in the bowl, and for some reason I just didn't eat it. I had other ones and I ate those, but I left one behind. And it just stayed there, and I just left it there for like literally over a year, and it didn't rot. It just dried, hollow, you know, and became this hard, hollow thing with, you know, seeds rattling around inside of it, and it was weird that it just passed from being fresh to being mummified without actually rotting. So we called it the incorruptible.
Do you remember when Froggy had that
drank
the pomegranate juice till it was
moldy. That was one of the suitable for advertiser screen, by the way.
I tell you, if you ever go to Iran, which probably most, unless there's some kind of regime change, most of you will probably never go there, right? They love a pomegranate there. They stick it into everything. Pomegranate chicken dish called Fesenjoon. But they're always trying to give you pomegranate. Always, you know, and I tend to turn it down because it gets stuck in my teeth. You know, so.
Yeah, oh, they're wonderful.
I love the flavor. I hate the seeds.
It's a pain. I just decided to spend the rest of the day like picking pomegranate out of my teeth. You know,
toughen up. I'm also a fellow who eats kiwi fruit without peeling them. So,
oh my gosh.
Anyway,
let's move on. Okay, so, right.
If you've just joined us, we're taking a trip through early albums of the 1970s by such bands as Renaissance. No, we're not. When is this from?
This is 909, and this is the Paris Psalter, which is a Byzantine book. Now, again, just in terms of world history at this point, after the Islamic invasions, the Eastern Romans basically just like totally constricted to like Greece and Anatolia. But by about 900, this is the kind of massive resurgence where Byzantine power is back. They're wealthy. They're kind of culturally vigorous, and interestingly, they're harking back to the Roman period. And again, We often think about the Renaissance being this moment that happens in Europe at, you know, like in the late medieval period, but actually the Byzantines had already gone through a much earlier rediscovery of Roman ideals and imagery previously. So what you'll note is I mentioned about the kind of archetypal Roman illustration being in a rectangle or a square. Again, you can see this is the return of that, but you've also got this is a Psalter, which is a fancy name for the Psalms. The Psalms, obviously, written by David. David plays the lyre. You can see across. So we've got David as a central figure, but who does he remind you of? Well, he reminds you of someone like Orpheus, who would often be surrounded by animals in Roman and classical figures. I also particularly love the devil down in red across in the bottom right hand side. But look at all of the kind of classical features to this. It's a really interesting mix of certainly with the poses and the rendering of the face is very classical. And look at the expression. The woman behind David, her hand. You know, it's got that kind of classical expression to it. But then look at the rock above Satan, you know, that's straight out of a Byzantine icon. So there's this very interesting rediscovery of the past.
Is Satan dressed as Caesar here?
I hadn't really noticed that. Yeah, he's definitely got a laurel on him. Yeah, I don't know the reason.
It's kind of a political comment, you know.
Each of these illustrations is relates to a specific psalm, and I'm really sorry I don't have them with me. So it's probably like a reference to like Satan's darts or something.
The animals are looking super miserable as well. Like that dog is like, you know, if only you knew bad things were. But look at look how miserable the sheep are as well. I wonder what's going on here. It's kind of some menace.
But I really love this. I really love this manuscript. It's super beautiful, and like I said, it's worth reading the Psalms as you look at the imagery. I put in quite a few others of this because they are really good quality. But again, this is David defending his flock from a lion. So you can see here, this is David almost as the clubman, you know, Hercules. I mean, he looks a bit chunky. I quite like. chonk David, and he's grabbing the lion with his hand. It's a shame about the damage there, but you can see the lion chomping down on a sheep. Maybe that's why the sheep are so unhappy, because they're just
I feel like they just want to be liberated from David. There's an undercurrent here that they're maybe they want to be saved by the lion.
Postmodern analysis of manuscript illustrations. Yeah,
what is this book called? Did you say?
Yeah, it's the Paris Psalter.
Paris Psalter, okay.
Yeah. But again, look at some of the clothing as well. So this is obviously that's a classic Roman outfit for David. But the rendering of the fabric there looks something more like a Byzantine icon as well. And there's other interesting bits, like I just like the person peeping around the corner. Can you see at the top of just above David's head there?
This one.
Yeah, no context, just peeping and saying
yeah,
hello.
And well, I noticed that there was a creeper there as well. Who's she then? She's creeping around the corner. This artist loves like miserable animals and creeps around every corner. You know, kind of interesting.
Yeah. Okay, next one.
Can I just ask, by the way, what colour is that? Round is round.
It's blue. Probably that's lapis, I would imagine. It's
around his chest there.
Oh, the good. Yeah, that is absolutely lapis, 100%.
Lapis lazuli, the kind of famous, beautiful, dark blue jewel. Very, very expensive. I believe at the time it was only mined in a single mine in Afghanistan. Again, yes. You're the lapis expert.
Yeah. Wow. I've followed Cennino Cennini's process to separate the. Because when you get lapis, it's sort of interlocked in a matrix with other minerals, and to get the most intense blue, you have to go through a process with alkaline chemistry to separate out the blue, which is called lazurite, by the way. But
so it's a hell of a quest to get hold of that then in this day.
Oh, it was extraordinarily expensive, the most expensive pigment, more expensive than gold, and often paintings were, when you would commission a picture, you would specify how much lapis you wanted to use, and you would pay an extra charge to get most of it in. Because of course it was obviously also because it was so expensive, it was used as a color of particular veneration for the Virgin, for instance. Very, very difficult to get.
Well, I would say, like, countering that, Because of the geopolitics of the time, basically the Sassanid Persians had collapsed, who were the kind of big rival, and obviously replaced by the Caliph. But by this period, there were a series of northern Turkic tribes people. You got people like the Peshengs. I can't remember them all, basically, but they'd come in from the north and taken over some more of the Persian land. But that basically opened up trade access to the east for the Byzantines. And so I think part of this kind of rediscovering of the past is access to the Silk Road again in an easier fashion, because the caliphs had previously blocked it pretty hard, basically. So,
yeah. In fact, I've got a piece of lapis that sits on my desk. So,
yeah. Yeah.
Is it still expensive, D,
when you actually buy it, like just the mineral, it's expensive, but it's not hugely expensive. But now the pigment, if you buy, and again, there are not many producers of the actual pigment. You can't just grind up lapis and use that as a pigment. You have to go through this process to separate out the blue component, as I said, which is a separate mineral called lazurite, and that is extraordinarily expensive. So, and I've done it myself. As I said, I've done it myself, and it's very difficult to.
Do you know where some of the big lapis mines are nowadays? They're all in Chile, and apparently, if you go to the, if you kind of drive along some of the kind of long roads in Chile, you'll often see like some miners flogging huge chunks of lapis to tourists, basically. So
yeah, the Chilean stuff isn't as good. It's not. It's generally not quite as good.
That is the thing about minerals that people don't appreciate, because it's a chemical thing. It isn't just because it's named something doesn't mean it has the same qualities or depth of color. I'll give you another example of this, and that's porphyry. Now, porphyry, the famous granite stone that was so loved by the Romans again, this deep purple color, all came from a single mountain in Egypt. I think it's literally called like Porphyrius Mountain or something like that. But there are porphyry mines in China, for example. A lot of modern granite stones for curbs are technically a porphyry, but they don't have the same chemical composition as that specific mine. So like stones are a lot more unique than we take them for, if that makes sense, and that they have, depending on where you get them from, have unique qualities because of the chemical makeup. Sorry, I interrupted.
It was just that there are mysterious things in this picture. Is it just me, or is there an eye there? Do you see that? Do you see in the rock?
Yeah, I can't see it myself, but maybe there is kind of some symbolic elements. Look, put in a lot
an
of
eye.
This.
Well, you can't really see it because it's I don't know. There's I might take a look at this book. There are odd elements in these pictures that I want to know more about. Anyway, let's carry on.
Yeah, that's not. By the way, I in case you're curious, I sent a Twitter DM to you a picture of my lapis here, so you can see the vivid color.
Let's have a look. Well, I can see an eye. Sod the lot of you.
There's no eye.
I'm gonna write a book arguing there's an eye in this picture.
It's kind of like the people who spend a lot of time writing about Da Vinci. He attracts a lot of kind of like, I see. Wow, that is very blue. If you see some of the Chilean stuff, it's kind of got like white, a lot more white flecks inside. So just because it's named something doesn't mean it has the same kind of quality. And I think ultimately it's down to the discerning buyer to identify, you know, what a beautiful rock.
Indeed.
Hold on. Ah, buggeration. Hold on a minute.
Sorry.
Right, hold on.
It's not edgy black china, it's Wedgwood.
There you go. Right.
Let's go to the next one. This was a very specific. I put this in just because it was super Roman on the left hand side. Look at the contrapposto on the leg. So again, this is the classic pose where you put all of your weight on one leg and have the other leg kind of resting slightly, and that creates again these dynamic forms, interesting forms. But again, this woman could literally have come straight out of a Pompeian fresco. I also particularly love the word of the Spirit of God shown as a hand here, which again, this gets picked up by the Western medievals. And you've got to remember that the whole of the medieval manuscript illustration comes out of Byzantine traditions again. They're taught by the Byzantines. They try and ape the Byzantines. And you'll often see these kind of hands rendered in a much simpler way in those versions.
I can read that. That's Isaiah, by the way, not from the saints. It's Christ, but Isaiah.
Oh, very good. Is
he brown? That's my question. Is he?
Well, he's ruddy. I mean, he's.
Is he meant to be?
He's a Levantine prophet, you know. So
right,
wandering in the.
I'm not sure whether I can't. Isaiah was with everyone, wasn't he? He was just kind of like, he's a bit of a neat, just sort of living indoors, prophesying all the time.
But I mean, I'm just saying this is the sort of thing that might be held up for the Wee Was Kangs crowd, you know.
Yeah. Probably.
He is painted a different color deliberately. So I don't know why that would be.
I mean, I know God is white in this picture. just FYI, you know.
Wow.
All right, let's carry on.
And yeah, this is the kind of writer of the book, and he, you know, puts himself into it. But again, I think it's a really beautiful book. Anyway, let's keep on going. We've got one other Byzantine classic. This is from the Monologion of Basil II. I have to put it in there because Basil II is just such one absolute champion emperor, famous for slaughtering Bulgarians and gouging out their eyes. And if you look at the back here, I think I mentioned about the dyed vellum. Now we've got the totally gold vellum at the same time. So again, these kind of super rich, expensive qualities to it. But you know, we're sort of moving away from some of that super classical Roman period. I mean, this is 100 years later, so I think that kind of Renaissance period's passed a little bit, and they're kind of adapting from some of those forms. And if you go to the next image, this is a very classic picture of Basil.
I just have to comment on the tights. Nice tights. Like these tights.
I mean, everyone wears leggings, you know. That's the thing. Leggings and a
looks like he's wearing
leggings and a top.
Remember in the in the kind of late 90s, all the girls wore those kind of really skimpy denim. It looks like he's wearing the denim, dead denim hot pants with the. Anyway, let's carry on. what's this?
Well, this is Basil II, and again, kind of show this is kind of like the last Byzantine document we'll see. Just a totally gold page. They've sort of got a bit of a contrapposto, but this is where more of those kind of iconic traditions come out of at the same time. But I just love the toadies below him just carrying. I mean, just look at these little minions below. Zoom in on the minions here.
Definite minion action going on here. Yeah. That's you. Right, okay, let's carry on. And who is this Basil? This fellow.
Yeah, that's here, Basil II. Right? Yeah, yes, that's right, yeah.
Awesome. Okay.
Okay, so... Basically, by this period, we've got many more European monasteries churning out works. At this point, I quite like this as a graphic piece. So it's an image of a saint. I think it's meant to be John the Baptist because of his long cross, but I could be wrong. But if you zoom in a second, you can see that the text has been sort of written over him at the same time, and you can read it. This is all in Latin here. Rex, so king. Okay, yeah, you can see Christ there in the center, but basically it's kind of like
I'm not kidding here, but he does actually look like cringe walker in real life. Am I wrong?
You're not wrong. He does look a bit like cringe. You're right. Yeah.
So okay, they've put writing over the top.
But I mean, also, it's like it's total. There's no spaces, no punctuation whatsoever. So it is a biblical text, but it's also a piece of graphic art at the same time. You know, this is.
It looks a lot like, you know, you buy those like books of puzzles where you do the word search.
The word search, yeah, it does look a bit. I mean, like
is,
the word search.
Is that what it is? Because I can see like the word imperial.
I mean, it's a full text, just written out without punctuation, without line spacing. Over the top of another image, and again, notice how they change the ink of the words when it's over the person as well, so you can get more of a contrast. But there's a bit of a period for this style as well. You see it again. I wonder if it's something to do with something like the Sartor squares. They're these kind of like mysterious esoteric text. Configurations, you know, there's power in the way that you lay out words. But again, I mean, Mr. D or Semiagog would know more about that.
Straussian would have a field day with something like this, wouldn't they?
Yeah.
All right. Let's carry on.
We're kind of moving on now to some of the kind of middle medieval period, and you've got the kind of rise of the bestiaries. And I particularly like this one. This is the Aberdeen bestiary. So again, this is another British. And you can read this today, and they've got translations as well. And something like a bestiary comes out of that tradition of those late Roman works where they're trying to understand the world. They're trying to explain things, and you have a picture of an animal and a little explanation about it. This is obviously an elephant, as you can see, with his trunk, and he's been eaten by a dragon at the same time, who's wrapping around the elephant and stealing him away. Obviously, because they're in Scotland, didn't get much exposure to elephants, so they'll be seeing pictures or from descriptions of what an elephant is. But I sort of like, I like the super, you know, there's something almost like a CGI rendered smooth elephant, you know, as opposed to the kind of wrinkled humble animal that it is.
And his ear appears to be a flower, which is interesting.
Yeah, exactly. I wonder if it was described as like a leaf or something like that, like a large leaf, and that's, they would do literal interpretations of that.
Bizarre.
And you would see these, say, like there weren't that many depictions, you know, there were and this continued on well into the, I would say, the 17th and 18th century, where you would get paintings and drawings and illustrations for books that and they would all have the same exotic animal, because they would all the artists would be using the same reference book, because of course many of them had never seen an elephant unless they lived somewhere like Amsterdam where there was a zoo. But you get the same elephant over and over again because they're all using the same sort.
I'm wondering if they've given them deliberately oriental eyes here. Is that like a deliberate place?
No, I'm not sure, because again, the traditions would come from those kind of Byzantine works. Quite famously, there is a Byzantine textile, which is an elephant, a series of elephants for Charlemagne's tomb in Aachen. So if you go to the Aachen treasury, and they have a similar eye to this, basically, it's kind of like a quite large teardrop shape. I just want to mention that Lundberg is trying to call me out and say this is not a dragon, this is a wyvern. Ooh. In medieval depictions, a dragon would only have two legs, and you can see that over and over again. And feel free to please check this bestiary yourself. Again, you can look it up and see the different listings, and you'll see the dragon only having two legs depicted. I mean, you can
suck on that, Lundberg.
It's really interesting, because at what point does the dragon get four legs? That's the question. And it's the high medieval period. But there is a reimagining of mythology during that high medieval period. The griffin, for example, massively changes in style as well. That there's several mythological creatures, the basilisk as well. I'm sure you'll be used to this from your D&D days, AA. But a lot of what's in those kind of monster manuals, etc., they're partly derived on medieval, but I would say it's kind of like actually like late medieval, and also a lot of just made up stuff in the meantime, a lot of fantasy stuff. So
that story I read last week, which was about the origin of the Welsh, featured a creature called the roe, which is basically like a kind of giant bird-like lizard, which is pretty much a dragon, but is described as a scaly bird instead, which has two legs, but they end up riding them at some point. I mean, I have no idea where those come, you know. It's all around this time though that they get coded. Yeah. About 1100.
There's also the rise of Lundberg has beaten me to it, the rise of heraldry. So many of these animals that you know the depictions that people became used to later on were influenced heavily by, you know, the dragon from heraldry, which of course has four legs. And you know, so that again the heraldic poses will, you know, the dragon rampant, the dragon passant, and all of these.
You know, maybe it's the need for rampant, because you can't have a rampant creature with two legs, basically.
No.
This dragon looks more Chinese. Gosh. This looks more Chinese to me, though, than other depictions of dragons I've seen.
Yeah.
This kind of, I don't know, if you were to show that to most people now, they'd say, oh, that's a Chinese dragon.
The Dregoch would be a heraldic dragon.
Just carry on.
Eating his own tail as well.
Oh, I quite like this one, the next one. This is Adam naming all the animals. If you remember in Genesis, one of his jobs is obviously as a caretaker for all the animals, but he names everything there as well, and he has dominion over all animals. And again, you've got this depiction of Adam fully robed for decency, of course, when he would in fact be nude, as this kind of medieval king. And then there are certain archetypes of animals. So, for example, the medieval lion looks a very specific way. It has this very kind of smooth head, almost like a ferret or something like that. If you zoom in on the top right-hand side there.
He looks like a whack-a-mole.
And that's a pure heraldic lion by this point. You know.
Yeah.
If you look at the, yeah.
The pose, etc. Yeah, but I really like his tail as well, where, again, they just don't know that it's like some fur, so they've got almost kind of like a split in it. I mean, something like you can see the stag there, which would have been recognised. Even that has been stylized quite heavy there, you got to remember, so that they're not bothered about realism. They're also attempting to do things like gradients. Sorry to interrupt, Dee. If you zoom in on the stags a second, like I said, because this is a graphic medium, it's hard to blend. So what they've done here is you've got a brown and a white, and there's different basically strata. They're building up layers and layers of lightened colors. You can, if you look closely, you can see the bands of color, but that's how they're creating these kind of different gradients. You can't blend these paints together, so it has this very graphic effect. But sorry Dee.
And I was just going to say I quite like the bottom. I quite like the you know, the cats. And is that a fox
or a rabbit? Maybe bottom left.
And no, the one in the center.
Oh yes, maybe you're right there.
Yeah, or a dog.
Well, I really have a facsimile copy of this, and I really like the fox entry for this, where they basically state that the fox is the is Satan's animal. It is the symbol of evil, and anyone who's been woken up at 3 o'clock in the morning with two foxes having sex knows that it's Satan's creature.
Oh, horrific noise.
But also, I believe that traditions of fox hunting come from this almost kind of ritualistic destruction of Satan, and that's where I think I would bring back fox hunting, but only in the format where we would, like, you'd have to make the fox as a scion of Satan or something like that, and you have to physically, the whole community has to kill an embodiment of Satan together as a group. I think that's an interesting idea.
I would suggest other prey for such hunts, but I won't do it on YouTube.
I would like to have an animated version of these animals where each one of them has like a deep existential crisis where they wonder like why God has cursed them to be made in this. You know, this rabbit down here.
I quite like them.
What did I ever do, Lord, to be like, what am I?
It's the cow. It's the cow in the middle. Yeah, look, zoom in on that ox there. Why do I exist? What is my purpose?
Yeah, well,
to make delicious steak for man. That's your purpose.
Or even this lion, you know. I was meant to be a lion, but I'm a look at me. Anyway, carry on.
Oh.
Very, very charming.
I always remember in Lee and Herring, which is featured on the, which is a show that, you know, is that, you know, 26 years old. And you can't,
yeah.
I mean, they had a long running sketch where one of them would start breaking down and saying, curse you, God, for making me this way. And that would be the denouement of my animated series. You could probably do it, probably like a Zoomer could do it in like 10 minutes using AI technology or whatever, you know. Look at this pig down here. Anyway, carry on.
I'm literally bacon.
I mean, they've
popping out of the frame as well. Yeah,
that's true. Again, it's clever, yeah.
It's a pig with the face of a fish or something. Yeah, anyway.
Okay, moving on a couple of hundred years. This is 1371 now, and I would say the kind of high period of this kind of Gothic illustration is French. And this is, I think, another Psalter here. But what the French, while they don't have some of the kind of classical elements that the Italians do at this time, have built up quite complicated ways of rendering humans in 3D. So you can see here everything. If you go back to the Adam with the animals, if we saw his chair a second, look, the chair is flat. You only see two of the legs. It gives this impression of like total flatness. Come only 100 years later, or 150 or something, then look at the chair that he's in. They're attempting to play with perspective here. They're putting that mm-hmm. chair in a three-quarter view. The figures, even though they are a bit goofy, are much stronger representations of humans themselves. Can we zoom in on some of the figures, actually?
That's me and my twink minion holding the book for me.
That's you, yeah, you're exactly. And then look even at the tiles behind here. They've made a real effort to have a vanishing point, so all of the tiles align to that distant point in the horizon.
How could you tell it was French, Pharaoh?
Yeah, exactly. Yes, yeah. Yeah. We shall have a wall of fleur-de-lis over here.
I could just tell by their noses. Kind of look great.
A lot of what people think of as the kind of image of the high chivalric Middle Ages are indeed from French iconography. Right?
Yeah, exactly. We have a lot to thank from the French from this period, I think.
Indeed, they're like the Très Riche by the Duc de Berry, famous manuscript from slightly later than this.
Just one other thing I wanted to mention was apart from this attempt of realism, there is new attempts to play with a space. So again, there is some kind of harking back to those late Roman examples of the rectangle or square format, but it's been elongated. They're trying to fill out the page. And they're also playing with the box they're in. So again, those Byzantine examples had like an ornamented box, but this has a Gothic arch as part of it, you know, so you're almost invited into the space. So it acts almost like a portal or a doorway to this image at the same time. And the kind of high Gothic period really marks a period of experimentation and imagination with illustration. If we go to the next next page, this is the Visconti Book of Hours. So again, but Books of Hours are again like clusters of various biblical works. But this is, in my opinion, just like it's a really totally wild book, both in terms of colours. But also the way they render the human. So if we look, this is the moment where I'm sure Dee is cursing this moment, the moment that Eve is created out of Adam's rib. So if you zoom in the center, please, AA. This is where it all goes wrong. There's Adam passed out on the ground, and then out of the rib, Eve is made. But the figures are, you know, fully rendered. They have a space in perspective. I think this is really beautiful, but then it's totally wrapped in this medieval madness at the same time. You know, they're almost sort of trapped in a big O, which is the first letter of a bunch of words, which is surrounded by animals, and that itself is surrounded by more animals. And also there's a much better rendering of an elephant in the bottom left-hand side there. You can see the element evolution massively going on.
I love the idea that Eve, right, just born, immediately starts moaning. And Adam is immediately like, yes, dear. Yes, dear.
And this form, the initial letter, you know, having the highly decorated, you know, sort of first letter of a text on a page. I mean, we still do this. In fact, of course, it's usually greatly simplified. It will just be that the first letter is much larger than, you know, the subsequent letters on the line. But this tradition of having the, which came from also from something called rubrication. It's still with us in one form.
Can I just comment on the quantum leap in the quality of the animals from the one we were looking at just now? I mean, look at the lion and the elephant and the rabbit, yeah. And they all look like actual versions of themselves.
Yeah, I mean, it's been about 200 years since that bestiary. It was, yeah, the bestiary's 1150, and this is now 1390. So again, this is really like the Renaissance has properly kicked off, I would say, by this period, even in the north. And this is hundreds of years of tradition, hundreds of years of people just understanding the different parts of an animal. And
is there any chance this artist saw a real elephant or a real lion?
I mean, take a look at the elephant bottom left here.
There may have been. I wonder. Look,
his ear is not a flower, for one. I mean, you know.
But the end of his trunk is some kind of like sucker or something. I don't know. That's this this looks like it's straight out of like a first edition monster manual for D&D, I think, or something. But I really like the lion behind him, though. I think that's really. Can you see? I think that's meant to be a lion sitting in this cave. I mean, giant size, but very beautifully done.
I think that's a monkey.
You think it's a monkey?
I think it's an ape of some sort. Yeah.
No, there's an ape on the right. On the right, these are ape. There's a bear, and this is a lion. That's a lion.
That ear doesn't look. That's not a lion. That is not a lion ear, even if, as they would have understood it. I think it's a bear. Yeah, it may be a bear.
They're saying it's a bear.
It'd be a bear.
Okay, I'll accept bear. But that's quite a charming bear. Yeah. So I mean, this is good, but I love the next one, just in terms of, you again, here's some more psychedelia for you, just in terms of the colors. And again, this period is a color explosion where, thanks to basically international Italian trade and also natural philosophy, new colors are being discovered, new colors are being rediscovered, and trade routes are making them accessible to more people. So you've already got this kind of super intense purples and greens that are unlike we've seen anywhere else before, even the Roman period. But I mean, just that fluorescent orange. I mean, there is basically a period where this comes in. I think there's even like mentioned in Lives of Artists about when this orange sort of arrives in Venice for the first time and how much of a shock it causes. I mean, think about... some of Mantegna's work will often use this super bright orange.
That would be vermilion. That would be cinnabar. I mean, of course, the alchemists figured out how to synthesize that mercuric sulfide quite early on. But certainly that was a nice shocking color. In fact, the word miniature, you know, so we often refer to these types of paintings as miniatures, comes from the use of minium, which was red lead, which was a pigment, and it was used quite extensively. And that may also be the orange, although this doesn't look like red lead in this one. But because many of these were kind of covered in this pigment and it was used so heavily, they were called miniatures. So that's where that word comes from. I mean, it could also be from minuscule, but that still had its roots in this color, minium mineral.
This one to me looks a bit Wizard of Oz, you know. It's like on the way to the Emerald City, you know. Yeah, a bit like maybe it's because of the vivid colors that are used.
The greens, maybe.
Yeah.
This is the stealing of the doors. I can't remember the exact part of the Bible where this is from, but some dude steals some doors. Again, I think the I think
are they wooden doors? Are they wooden doors to come back to? Was Jesus a carpenter?
Stone doors.
Bloody Joseph can't make a dime, tell you. Carry on.
That green is also malachite. So if people are familiar with that that stone, which was used much later on, famously, it's also associated with Russia quite heavily. But yeah, that's malachite, which is a beautiful kind of pale, vibrant pale green, you know.
One other thing to mention is, can you see the little coats of arms? That I think that is literally the Visconti coat of arms as well, which is plastered through the book. So again, it's just a way of paying tribute to the patron. And again, the importance of the patron and artist, fundamental. And again, something I think we've lost in today's age. Everything is so transactional. You know, it's much more collaborational.
Is that another dragon as well? On the shield.
I think it's just a snake, is it?
Serpent, yeah.
Serpent.
Heraldic, sir.
Fair enough.
Okay, I included this one because there was recently an exhibition all about Alexander the Great at the British Library that I attended. And this may not be of... you may not know this, but the... Alexander Chronicles, as they were called, were one of the most important and well-read medieval documents of the time. And it was a Christian reimagining of the life of Alexander the Great. It included many things like his victory over the Persians, but also included many fantastical adventures, including such moments as the time that Alexander went to the bottom of the sea in a great glass vessel. And I just love this for me, just some, like the medieval imagination, and there's humor as part of it. So on the left-hand side, you've got the boat, and obviously the people on the boat are massively sized, but if you were to show reality here, it just wouldn't look as good. And then you've got Alexander, he's not impressed. There's a series of lights in his vessel.
He's got lamps.
A chicken and a cat. And he's about to go down. And there's many versions of this. And
this is mental, Pharaoh. This is properly like kind of... I had no idea that Alexander went in a glass vessel with a cat and a bloody cockerel.
There's some really, really good stories. All about Alexander, because the other famous one, actually, I'll tell you now, is his ascent to heaven, because obviously Alexander, being great, is a Christian. But how does he get to heaven without Jesus? Well, what he does is he either goes on a chair or straps himself into some kind of cage, which is attached to two griffins, and uses two slabs of meat to bait them into ascending to heaven.
Absolutely mental.
But you need to look out for this, because you'll see this icon everywhere. And I was at Gloucester Cathedral but the other day, and lo and behold, I saw carved into one of the wooden choir stools was this figure of Alexander. Maybe I'll get a picture of it, because it's a really interesting symbology. A second, but maybe just chat among yourselves a second.
Well, this is a rather sinister looking cat as well, I think. I mean,
yeah, well, as someone says, the cat is enjoying looking at all the fishes.
Dark. And this fish here, what is that? Like, it's got teeth.
Well, lots of fish have teeth.
So, you know, quite fearsome.
Anahicus lupus. That's what
quite,
it is.
Quite a fearsome fish.
It's a wolf fish or a dog fish, something like that.
Okay, I've got two versions for you to look at. AA, I've done it in private chat.
Okay.
I mean, it's worth it, because it just sums up the medieval mind here. So there you go. He's on a chair, strapped to griffins, and he's luring them to heaven with the meat.
Why does he look like Margaret Thatcher playing the Queen or something?
I mean, this isn't the best illustrator. But look out for that, especially that the can you see that the meat on the stick with the arms? You see that everywhere as well. The, like that that's
the flayed meat on a stick. Yeah,
yeah. There's the other image is quite good as well. There you go. Yeah, in the cage.
Absolutely.
I remember a tale of someone from the Middle East ascending to heaven on a chair, except of course he had rockets on the chair. I wonder if it had some relationship.
Yeah, you're probably right. Well, of course, Alexander the Great is in the Shwazawamadang. What's that Persian book?
Oh yeah,
Shahnameh.
Yeah, the Shahnameh. Yeah,
Al Iskander. Well. Al Iskander. Yeah, because they assumed that since his name started AL, that he was Arab. I'm not joking about that. The word Iskander is from his name. So
amazing. Yeah. Well, I didn't know about this. There's the meat on the top.
Yeah,
there we are.
the gothic imagination. You know that this is. I'm going to mention him. Ruskin talks about in the nature of Gothic, the grotesque, and he says there's two types of Gothic grotesque: the sportive, and the horrific. And the medievals played with this idea of something that's horrific but also quite funny at the same time. So that's why you have this kind of like sinister but humorous situations.
I kind of dig this little surreal period that we're looking at here. So
it's just full of fun and imagination. And again, like we think of this medieval time as a time of like rules and regulations and everyone's like hard up, but certainly from an artistic perspective, they're breaking boundaries and like creating new traditions and adapting old ones as well. You know, it's very innovative.
Like Alexander got to heaven in a cage dragged by griffins who were after some meat, for example.
Yeah.
Let's carry on.
Yay, printing.
Yeah, so we've got our first, finally, 1 hour 40 in, we're in the first print thing. Do you want to talk about the history of print?
Oh, dear, oh, dear, oh, dear. Okay, well, in a very distilled version, we talk about that. I mean, so as we mentioned this earlier in the stream, but of course there were kind of all sorts of precedents for what became movable, what we call movable type. And of course, you know, there was a kind of block printing and seal printing used in China very early on, you know, and other places as well. And most people kind of know this story, but then of course, you know, in the kind of Western imagination, there was a man called Johannes Gutenberg, who was from Mainz in Germany. And I believe that around 1440, something like that, you have to read him. He had a very interesting life, including getting into some shady transactions and other businesses. But he also got into the trade of producing books. And of course, he didn't invent movable type, but he, with other influences, became involved in the business of intaglio printing. And so this would be basically printing from a raised surface, like a piece of metal type. So, and famously made the 42, the 42 line Bible. See, I'm misremembering all of this. We should cover all of this in a separate font and type episode. But basically, it was in the 1400s that movable type and printing came to Europe. Of course, this was a massive innovation. We talked about this a bit on the last stream, but suddenly you can produce books without having to write them by hand, without having to have scribes. You know, again, by setting pieces of metal type, which are basically a small raised letter, you know, in reverse, and you can sort of put these in lines, make all the words, set it in a frame, put it on a press, ink it, and you can produce a copy of the book. And so suddenly you can print dozens and dozens of copies. You don't just have one. You don't just have one richly illustrated scribal manuscript. You can start to produce these. Now, of course, the Gutenberg Bible, you know, as people will all know, that was sort of, it had a foot in both worlds. It was printed on vellum, but there were less luxurious copies of it printed on paper as well. So, but they were also hand rubricated. So what would happen is, of course, after it's printed, someone would go in, basically someone with scribal training, and they would still add the kind of flourishes and decorations and colors to it. So again, there was still a foot in this world, but very quickly, of course, the process became almost, you know, sort of entirely mechanical, without someone doing something to it. So of course, this was revolutionary. Books printed in this period, basically from the advent of European printing to the year 1500, are called incunabula. And so these will be the kind of you know, the birth of printing and the spread of books and knowledge. But yes, the nature of books changed entirely with this innovation. And so I don't know. That's a very rough summary. And when we if we do a proper stream about printing and type, I will do all the research so I can refresh my memory about the specifics. But yeah. What else?
I mean, just from my perspective, I would also say that in terms of like where it started and the centers, you got to think of Germany, you got to think of Austria, and also Venice and Italy as kind of like being the three early hotspots. Now, the problem with printing is, the advantage of printing is that you, like I said, you can get ideas out there fast. And the problem with printing is that you can get ideas out there fast. So it was good for some people and absolutely awful for others, usually the authorities. And I would say that the history of printing is it's tied to censorship and basically control of this powerful force of media, because the elites, rather wisely at the time, realized the power that media had over people in terms of transferal of ideas. You know, as I often go about in the propaganda streams, we pretend like media has no sway over the minds or the capacity to move people. But the wise ancients of their time realized that this could be a force for great good, but also a force for great evil. And the long and the short of it is that due to various wars, a lot of people ended up in Venice and in Austria to do their print houses. I mean, the big advantage of printing as well is that it's, you know, it's relatively small. You know, like how big would you say a printing workshop would be, D?
Oh, I mean, you could get away with, you know, having, I would say, probably three or four people. You know, I mean, that would be a very small one. There were very large ones, but you know, you would have a compositor, so you would have someone who would be setting the type. You would also probably have someone who did all lots of menial labor around that. You would have, of course, pressmen. You would have people who actually had to operate the press, which would be, you know, again, very difficult manual labor. But you could certainly have a printing establishment with four or five people, you know, who could produce within space of, you know, a couple of weeks. Many, many copies of a book, or broadsides, or anything else you want.
Yeah, so. Yeah, exactly. And like, just in terms of physical space, we're talking about the size of a shop here, like a medium-sized shop.
Small.
Yeah, yeah. So it's very movable at the same time. And so what you tend to find with these printers is, if they're driven out through censorship or they're driven out through wars, they would often relocate. And that is the story behind this work by Erhard Ratdolt, which is a great, great last name here, 1477. So, you know, relatively early on. I haven't included some of the earliest works because I wanted to focus on specifically the kind of illustration and the ornamentation. I won't talk about the font as well because the font here is particularly beautiful. But
yeah,
the early printers here are trying to capture capture elements of manuscript writing. So again, just the format here where the text is in a rectangle shape. Well, what does that look like? Well, that just looks like every single manuscript we've looked at previously where an image or the text is in that unique format. And these kind of ornamented borders were also very common during this kind of during manuscript writing at this time. And I guess you've got to also remember that it wasn't like printing happened and then all of the manuscript writers just like gave up on that day. It was a gradual process, and the kind of works that were being produced were different as well, where again there's lots more liturgic works at this time with manuscript illustrators as opposed to humanistic texts, you know, revivified Roman works, etc., etc., being shared around. But I really quite love the what's the name of the beautified first letter again, D?
Well, it's called an initial letter, or initial, you know, it's letter, a vestige, yeah, of a rubrication, but usually it's called an, yeah, initial letter. And still, in fact, Albrecht Dürer produced a very famous set of initial letters for printing.
Well, yeah, hold on to the Dürer chat a second, because I've got some of his stuff later. But what's interesting is basically that then, like, why didn't they just go full utilitarian at this point? Why didn't they just say, let's just churn out as much stuff as possible? and some people did, but I think many of these woodblock carvers were artists with a tradition and wanted to continue that tradition in their own right. And they were just adapting to a new medium as well. So while printing is, you know, a subversive form in many ways, it is the birth of a new tradition and new guilds. So again, can we just zoom in on the ornamental board around the outside here? You know, just in the same way that letters and type were cut, these borders would be cut as a single wood block. Now, typically, from what I've read, you'd want to use end grain boxwood, which has a very tight grain formation. I've done a few woodcuts in my time. None of them very good, but essentially you mark out the pattern on your piece of wood. You then will use a very sharp knife to cut out the edges, and then use a series of gouges to cut out the gaps in between, giving the kind of white parts, so to speak. And you could enhance that with some special gouges like a V gouge, etc., to create some specific forms. Artistically, I would say that this is a move away from that kind of over-the-top grotesque medievalism, and there are emphasis on the Renaissance. So you can see like the Renaissance shields at the bottom there, you know, like that's, think of St. George, Donatello's St. George, for example, has exactly the same kind of shield. Even the border, it's naturalistic, but it's simplified. It's more real. You know, all of these ideas of returning to nature in humanist circles, etc.
Also, Ratdolt was he was born in Augsburg, but he worked in Venice, and you can tell that because this is a Venetian type, Venetian typography, which set a standard for Roman style type. I say again, it's funny, Roman Venetian, but this is called Roman type, but it is a Venetian type, Venetian Roman type. And it set the standard for this this type of letter form, you know, for hundreds of years. Except, of course, now it will end because Zoom is too stupid to understand serif typefaces. But the border would be carved, as Ferro said, from a wood block, and then the type, which would be composited and set, and of course this is metal type, would be then just placed inside this frame. They could be printed at separate times, so that it was possible to print the frame and then print the text inside of it, but that would require, you know, quite careful registration. But it could be done, or it could all be printed at once, because of course this is all intaglio printing, and so you just ink the whole block up and put it through the press.
I was just going to say the old Austrian economist in me sniffs jobs for the boys here. You said like why didn't they just go straight to utilitarianism? I mean, I bet you if you were to look into the ins and outs of that industry, there's some control somewhere maintaining jobs for the boys, because I bet you when that was removed at whatever time, they disappeared. That's just a hypothesis, but I reckon if you went into it, there'll be something keeping it in place.
Rank materialist analysis by AA Hitz, because these are essentially artistic men, proud of their
jobs for the boys,
proud of what they're doing. You know, the thing is, they wanted to create something as fine as manuscripts. They I think my impression that I got from reading around is that yes, they were producing in some ways cheap copies of the kind of manuscripts, but they wanted their things to be as beautiful, if not more beautiful, you know, and especially this is all tied to this kind of wave of humanism, the emergence of the middle class. This is the exciting new format. This is the medium of a new generation, of a new vital culture in society that they wanted to be at the forefront of. But
there were people, I mean, from very early on who also tried to make books on the cheap. So there is another a very famous printer from the Incunabulum period called Aldus Minucius, who, in addition to other things, I mean, it's very famous for a type of he founded a press called the Aldine Press, and he was very famous for typefaces and other innovation. But he also printed these small books called, I believe they're called Incuridia, and they were meant as little books that you could carry around with you, which would have fairly, you know, they'd have very minimal decoration in them, and they would be prints of popular texts, you know. And so basically, Aldus Minucius invented the prototype of the paperback book in the very early days of printing, basically around 1500. So yes, there was, as Ferro says, a maintenance of a very high artistic tradition, but there were also people from very early on who said, you know, how can we meet the mass demands of a suddenly new market? So
I mean, I know a bit later on you get, like, I mean, this is, maybe 100 years after this, but in Elizabethan England, you get entire genres just wiped out overnight due to cost, essentially. The biggest casualty of that period was the Chronicle. You know, they used to have these massive almanacs and chronicles and things, and which were the sources for many of Shakespeare's plays. And it was like the release... It was like the print versions, the cheap print versions that they released of those plays, and various other small books like Dee was talking about, that basically just killed the market for the Chronicle pretty much overnight. In about, I was in 1595 or something, you'd have to double check the dates, but after a certain time, they don't. I have a book somewhere which is about the circulation of coinage in the early modern economy. And it looks at things like that. It just looks at actual sales figures of various different things. And they're, I mean, you could say it's like materialism, but it's also just like a fact that certain kind of market mechanisms do then dictate what sort of thing is printed as time goes on. And I think that because paper was really expensive in that time as well, which you guys mentioned last week. So you do get a kind of it does get more utilitarian as time goes on, just because they like couldn't afford to dick around with stuff like this, you know. I mean, maybe in like one or two, like, you know, manuscripts that are even preserved or whatever, but in terms of like the mass market of like what was bought and sold on, you know in the market in London or something, as time goes on you get less of this stuff. From what I can remember and what I've seen for this sort of thing. So Anyway, let's go carry on.
I just followed this up with another one of his works here. The big disadvantage of these kind of woodcut illustrations over the manuscript ones is the total restrictions on color. And essentially, there are two colors you can go for. We can either do black or we can do red. I do not know why you are not able to stabilize pigments in a similar kind of way. Maybe it's just a cost thing. Maybe Dee can jump in here, because this will all be linseed oil as the medium, yeah?
Yes, yeah, so printing inks would be, in fact, they would be boiled linseed oil. So basically, you would make varnish, because it couldn't be, it had to be very thick in consistency for it to properly work. And there were many ways of doing this. There were all sorts of traditions associated with it as well. But I would say it was also partially because of tradition. So of course, many manuscripts, you know, handwritten scribal manuscripts, as the things we've looked at before, would have been, the text would be written in black ink, and then there would be what I called rubrication, which comes from a word for red. And so if you look through many books produced before the advent of printing, you will see that the text is primarily black and red, things done in red to sort of highlight them, you know, draw attention to them, make decorative initial letters and stuff. So there was a tradition for all text, you know, for books being mostly black and red, except for illuminations and decorations. But black certainly was cheap. And of course, it's easier to read. So I just don't think there would be that much call for producing lots of colored inks, because of course it would be very difficult and very expensive to produce multicolored woodblock illustrations. In fact, they didn't really do it at all in Europe. You know, I mean, we think of the sort of famous Japanese woodblock prints, and those were very difficult to do because, of course, you would have to do them in multiple passes. You had to print each color separately. Now, this illustration here, this shows that they printed the text and the woodblock separately, because of course you had to print one color at a time. You couldn't have print red and blue at the same time with this way of printing. But I would say it's partially economy, but partially just the tradition, you know. And there was still, I mean, you know, for years after the advent of printing, you would get hand colored. You know, you would have people whose job was to go through these printed books and do very rough watercolor coloration of these, and you'll often find these kind of you know, sort of illustrated biblical works and such with hand coloring, and that extended well into the 18th century. Of course, that's how William Blake did many of his books. They were printed and then hand colored.
Right. I've only got about 10 minutes left, so if we could just do these last couple, and then maybe we'll have to draw a line on the stream. But going back to what I was saying before about how, you know, printing press didn't kill illumination instantly. It was a slow death, and actually some of the finest illuminations occur in the 15th and 16th century, or early 16th. This is 1480, the Black Book of Hours. Again, another French book. Each page dyed black with a silver, like a silver ink being used for the lettering. But again, having that dark ground allows you to do a couple of different things. Have some of these really beautiful contrasts between the blues and the blacks. But also, if you zoom in on the left-hand side, you've got Mary, I'm pretty sure. If you can you see that they've sort of created an almost etching-like cloth effect using the black ground and then a gold pen over the top? So it's just a technique to create shadow and highlights at the same time. But I think this is a very beautiful book. And again, there's many good quality illuminations in here. Again, they're using similar rectangular formats, but this is I would say the high Gothic period is like has some of the best content borders. I particularly like the little bird on the right hand side swooping down.
It's like the phoenix singing his most beautiful song as he immolates himself. I mean, this was the end of this great tradition, but also, as you say, I mean, the extraordinarily beautiful works.
Just one note on the type. Notice how this looks a lot like Gothic type. Or what's it called?
Black letter. Yes.
Oh, black letter, not black face. Oh, type.
Yeah, it wasn't blackface.
Which basically aimed to try and copy the handwritten illumination work.
Sort of calligraphy.
Let's keep on going. So this one, it's really hard to see. I think I've got a separate link here because it is worth doing the zoom in on these ones. Okay, hold on a second. The Americans have managed to scan this. I've just put it in private chat. Sorry, AA. If you don't mind.
Is he still with us?
Yes, I'm still here.
Oh, okay.
The coffee's run out.
Also, whilst we're figuring this out, I should just say that the northern countries tended to get black letter, and Italy was associated with the Roman faces. So, like William Caxton, who was the innovator of printing in England, his types were black letter, so that became the tradition for years afterwards.
That's about as good as it gets, I think.
Yeah, you can zoom in really far now with this. This is kind of, they've done like a super high resolution scan. There we go. So, I mean, this is many individual scenes here. We're way past those kind of gawky flat imagery. I mean, it sort of reminds me of like Mantegna or that kind of in between. Like true classicism, etc. But these are like Roman jewels all the way around. You've got this kind of interesting gradient effect. You can see the cameos being integrated. The font is really beautiful. This is almost like a classical scene with satyrs across here at the bottom. So this is like a proper early like true classicism. And then there's the sort of meta text here. So can you see the actual writing is it's like a Trump door or whatever it's called. It's made to look like, if you look, can you see the edges of the white paper are meant to look like a scroll or something like that, mm-hmm. which is then on the actual page itself. So it's kind of like this additional beautiful effect.
And I am the author. Look, AA. No, I'm joking.
If you look very closely, you will see that, again, this is not, even though it looks like it's gradated, it looks like kind of very smooth blending, the type that you would see in oil paint. It's not. If you look very closely, you'll see that all of the gradations are made up of tiny, tiny little brush strokes. And so you can, it's an enormous amount of work to get this effect.
Do you want to see the other one? There's another one by this guy. I'll just send it in chat again. We might have to leave it there after this.
4 hour stream.
Oh yeah, this is an Aristotle work again. So again, showing that even these big illuminated works, you clicked a button to make it full stream, a full size last time. I don't know how you did that. It was like on the task bar at the bottom, maybe.
Oh, there we are.
Yeah. I mean, look at the monkey there. On the right hand side.
There he is. There's the monkey. Look. Zoom in anymore.
I mean, again, strong hat game here.
Very, very strong hat game. Yeah. They're quite modern, those hats.
Yeah, I was thinking that.
Where are they from, these guys? Any ideas?
Well, I think those ones are meant to be Ottoman, aren't they, with the hats? But maybe, I know. Maybe Venetian. It's hard to tell.
Yeah. Do you know where this was produced?
I think it is a German piece.
Yeah, it looks German. This could be German hats. Oh, they got feathers in them, so they very well be.
Oh no, it's Andrea Torresilianus and Bartolomeu de Blavis in Venice.
Oh, okay, Venetian then. Hmm.
Well, Venice was the meeting place of many different cultures. Yeah. So that's why you've got the Ottomans meeting other groups. So it isn't necessarily Venetians. And is that a Dominican monk on the left-hand side?
Yeah, prior.
There's Marcus. Let's carry on. Is it... Do you want me to go back to the other images, Pharaoh?
Yeah, might as well. Maybe we could just do one more. Maybe, but if you want to do super chats quickly, or if there's been any.
Hold on a minute. How do I get back to that? There, here we are. Here we go.
So again, you've got other innovations like broader use of colours. You've got total perspective now. You've got kind of total breaking out of space. Again, there's this focus on realism, and you're meant to be looking at real flowers, basically. That's why they put all of these drop shadows behind them, all the attention to detail, etc. You know, very beautiful. And there's one more next to it as well. No, if you go to, I think it's messed up the order again. It's okay. I have to basically drop off in a second now anyway, so.
Okay. Okay. All right, then. Let's, okay, I can hear the noise is getting, louder. Pharaoh is being engulfed in a flame of domesticity by Pharaoh.
Thanks, chaps.
Oh, bye, Pharaoh. Shall we just continue on?
No. I don't think there's been any super chats, D. So
no super chats. You buggers. You absolute buggers.
No super chats for this stream.
Freeloaders. Fucking freeloaders.
It's often the way with streams like this.
It's true.
I mean, there's nothing for them to super chat about. They don't know what we're talking about. So
no, they don't know what I'm talking about.
People tend to want to super chat about, you know, Donald Trump and things like that.
I climbed up on a ladder to get this book for nothing. So.
Anyway, D, anything you would like to promote, sir, before we get out of here? You're going to do a space later, maybe?
Yeah, might do a space later on. But yeah, hopefully we can do a typography stream if people are interested. And as far as I don't know if we're going to continue. Pharaoh's, he's probably got more material, so I don't know if this is going to continue.
Well, I'm just having a look at that folder, and yeah, there's a few more images. There are a few more images. It goes to 1925.
Oh God! Dear, oh God! Okay, but I think I would like to really do a refresher for myself before we did proper typography stream.
Well,
today,
next week I'm going to do the Jordan Peterson thing.
Oh, is that a deepest law? Okay.
Well, I wasn't going to do it as a deepest law, but I am now on the basis that if I don't do it as a deepest law, it's just not going to get done.
I think a lot of people are looking forward to that. So
I'll do that this time next week. There has been a super chat by Blue Wizrobe who says, "I heard there were no super chats, so here is one." Well, thank you very much.
I think Radlib sent a super chat earlier. I thought I saw one.
I think it was a member. I think it was one of those members.
Oh, things. It's one of those. We don't read those.
Well, yeah, well, they don't show up in the super chat thing. They don't show up in the. They don't.
Oh, look, Clear the Mount has sent 20 secs for the Bowie streams.
Yeah, for the Bowie streams. And Wiggles has sent £2 for the Andrew Marvell stream. So there we go. I will. And Hello has just sent like a face with drool coming out of it. So that, thank you very much for that, guys. I will be back. Well, I have the Myths and Legends, also the shorts every morning, of course. Although those shorts are going to run out, and I have not had chance to record any more. I think the last day that the shorts are scheduled to come out is 25th. When's that? Saturday.
That is
so
Saturday.
On Sunday morning, there'll be no short. I do AA radio on Sundays, and actually there may be a WWYD stream on Sunday as well, because there's a, yes, that's probably the last one before, so then I may do my little bonus stream on Sunday. An RCW has come in with a last minute £20 super chat. Thank you so much for that. Wow. It means so much. He says a fiver for Team Rocket. Is that a Pokemon? That's a Pokemon reference. Did you ever watch Pokemon, D?
No.
I'm Jesse. That. I'm James. Team Rocket. And they have
I think I was at university when Pokemon came out.
They were very they were like the original transgender Jesse and James.
Oh.
Team Rocket, because they were like brother and sister, but they were incredibly gay. And they had a little cat as well. I'm not making this up. Look. Team Rocket. There they are. I'm Jesse. I'm James. Team Rocket. How do I know this? When I was much too old to watch Pokemon, it's because I have a younger brother. And look, there's literally James cross-dressing. Look at that. Subversive enemy.
That's enough.
So I ended up getting secondhand a lot of the, I guess you'd say, millennial kid shows, because my brother's 6 or 7 years younger than me. So that's how I kind of know that. Anyway, thank you very much, everyone. See you later. Get out. Now I have to drive home in the thick traffic. I'm going to have to get used to this new rhythm, D. It's gonna take me a while to get used to. Bye, everyone.
What goes on in this town is none of your business.
As long as I'm living here, it is.
Then maybe you shouldn't be living here!
Well, that's easily fixed.